Winter's creeping closer, the days are getting shorter and darker, and of course, Halloween's right around the corner, a perfect time to talk about monsters. And not just the classic Halloween monsters like vampires and werewolves. Every culture has its own unique terrors. Joining us now to talk about them is David Gilmore. He's the author of the new book, Monsters, Evil Beings, Mythical Beasts, and All Manner of Imaginary Terrors. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Every culture, back to the beginning of human history, it seems, has produced some form of monster. Why is that?
Well, I think that the human mind needs monsters. We need some kind of image that we can place all of our fears and our terrors and our anxieties on and make it come to life and then deal with it.
Kind of like a big, nasty id?
I think that's partly it. I mean, everyone thinks the monster is the eruption from the id, evil and aggression and sexual sadism and so on. But in my research, I found it's a little more than that. It represents our own attempts to find some way to express our evil feelings towards others, our malevolence, but it also threatens us at the same time. So it's kind of a dual image in which we can expiate both our aggression and our guilt. And the guilt, of course, comes from the superego, not the id. So I think it's a combination of unconscious qualities that are coming to life in the monster figure.
Are monsters always scary? In other words, are they always something that we need to fear and slay or conquer?
Well, one of the qualities of monsters everywhere is that they threaten humanity. They're big, they're man-eating, they're always cannibalistic. But in many cases with these monsters, for example, the Sphinx or the medieval dragons or so on, the monsters were fought by heroes who conquered them, and then the monster may become a servant to man. But this is pretty rare, but it does happen. In other words, there's kind of a mixed relationship here where it's not necessarily antagonistic. It starts that way, but if we play our cards right and follow the right formulas, we can turn the monster into a benevolent figure, which I think figures with the basic human enterprise, which is turning nature to our own ends.
And do these monsters come from actual creatures, or are they all purely imaginary? And I'm thinking just off the top of my head, the Loch Ness Monster, which some say is fictional, others say may not be.
Right. Well, that's the power of the monster, is to know whether it really exists or it's only in the mind. But what I found is that in all the cultures I looked at, which is just about everywhere in the world, and the past and present, that the monster image, what's called a monster, whatever the language may be, is kind of a recombination of existing organisms. In other words, it's part fish, it's part mammal, it's got reptilian qualities. It always is infused with one extra quality that animals don't have, and that, of course, is human malevolence. So it combines the worst of the animal and the human kingdoms. And this is what makes it monstrous, is that it breaks down all barriers and recombines things in bizarre and grotesque ways.
And you say that there are a lot of serpent and dragon monsters.
Yes.
Why is that?
Yes. Well, the dragon and the serpent, they're slimy, they're reptilian, and they often come from deep within the earth or from the sea. And these, of course, are unknown places.
And then, and if you really wanted to be Freudian, you could say that's our subconscious, really.
Well, part of it is. I think it may be beyond that. I think it may go back to our earliest experience as a species on the earth, when the oceans, humans were tiny, and our predators were huge. Saber-toothed tiger, the great cave bears that our early ancestors had to battle with, and many of these things were frightening, and many did come from the sea, and of course humans didn't swim that well in those days, and this was an unknown part of the world, the cave, the sea, and we were at the mercy of much stronger animals who were indeed monsters to us. I mean, I don't want to get Jungian about it, but it may be some great species-wide pan-human memory of our early experience on Earth, combined with, of course, the experience of the child who fears the larger objects in the world.
Right, and children in general, across the board, seem to have monster nightmares, a monster hiding under the bed. No one teaches them that.
All children have this, and this is true in all cultures, and this is often played to by their parents, who use these fears for instruction or to threaten children with punishment. So this is absolutely universal. Children draw monsters, they imagine them, they fear them, they look for them under their beds, and they're always afraid of being attacked, and most often eaten. There's always that fear of dismemberment. the most terrible things we can think of, we associate with the monster image, and all children are prone to this imagining.
Well, it's interesting that in popular culture, at least, we tend to tame the monster and make him a nice guy. I'm thinking of Darth Vader, for example, or the Grinch, even.
Well, it happens sometimes, but don't forget that sometimes it doesn't. There's still the science fiction movies where the monster is all evil and must be destroyed at the end. There's a sympathy. Remember King Kong at the end?
Yes.
'Twas beauty killed the beast. There's some sympathy for...
Yeah, the poor monster.
Yeah, the poor monster, because the monster is that part of us which is disdained, which is repulsive, which is criminal, which is thrown out, but it's a part of us.
Mm.
And so we identify with that and we pity it, I think, because it's a little bit of all of us.
David Gilmour, he's the author of a new book called Monsters, Evil Beings, Mythical Beasts, and All Manner of Imaginary Terrors. Thank you.
Thank you.